So this is the novel I'm working on now is called The Swan Gondola, and it's set in 1898 at the Omaha World's Fair. I guess that's all you need to know. So this is the very beginning. It may end up not being the beginning when the book is actually finished, but for now it's the beginning. And it starts with a letter, and it's dated October 31st, 1898. To a doll-faced doll with a heart-shaped heart. I wish this wasn't a love letter at all, Mrs. Meadows. Here's what I wish I was telling you in this letter, that I've forgotten everything about you, and that I'm never, ever thinking about you, not even for a minute. I want to say to you that it wouldn't even occur to me to sprinkle this paper with your favorite perfume, because I remember nothing about that extract of sweet pea, or how it smells like springtime, even in wintertime, at the nape of your neck, or the square bottle it comes in with its pale pink ribbon. I don't remember you on the bench of the Swan Gondola, your bare feet lifted from your slippers, a sea-green paper parasol spinning on your shoulder. If you ever receive this letter, you best burn it before you lay eyes on it. This letter is too conflicted, Mrs. Meadows. I never want your heart to break the way my heart is broken. I don't believe in ghosts, but maybe I'll believe in yours anyway. I'm trying to escape you and everything else, but mostly you, and that's why I'm up in these clouds. But that's all I'll ever tell you about my whereabouts. Your restless spirit shouldn't try to find me, haunt somebody else. And when I'm a ghost too, my ghost won't go anywhere your ghost goes. So many people came to the fair today on Halloween in costumes, and you might have been among them, for all I know. I did feel I could see something of you in every masked woman I passed. There'd be a quick beat of recognition in my heart when a woman happened to be looking up and off the way you always did. Not like your nose was up in the air, but like you were studying a pattern in a cloud or following the flight of a bird. And I don't mean to say you were ghostly even before you died. You were not some illusion. You were never frail, never dreamy, sickly, doomed, never. You were none of those things. That's why I still see you alive, living, everywhere I look. I made quite a fool of myself in front of a woman dressed as Marie Antoinette. Her costume was much finer than the one you'd worn every night for the Chamber of Horrors. Hers was silk and satin, and her wig looked freshly spun and powdered. She had that sweet habit of yours of twisting a loose strand of hair round and around your finger, but it was all part of the contraption of her disguise. With each tug of the curl, she fluttered the wings of the three toy butterflies in her wig. My own mask pushed up from my face and atop my head, I watched Little Miss Not You for minutes and minutes, convincing myself you'd returned, even as I failed to see very much of anything of you in this stranger. I became certain, though, that I knew very well the beat of her tiny pulse in her throat and a freckle at the inside of her wrist. I followed her as she weaved through the street, the crowd parting for her and her grand skirts that bounced and shimmied like on a spring. I finally said your name, touched her elbow, and she turned, a mask of peacock feathers held to her face by a stick in her hand. I touched her wrist and lowered her mask. I didn't recognize her, but she recognized me. I mean to say, she recognized my sadness, and her happiness fell, and she stepped back, away, her mask returning to her eyes. The fair ends today, my love. I'm so glad you won't see it. Everyone was thieving. They're like Hansel and Gretel tearing away at the buildings of sugar. They're breaking windows, toppling cornices, they're snatching spoons and salt shakers. The fair is to be torn down, beam by beam, the lagoon drained, the carpets rolled up, starting tomorrow. It'll all be gone, whether we take it or not. All I took was a balloon, which is mostly thin air anyway. If they would let the place fall apart, I would visit the ruins as an old man, a better man than I ever could have imagined I'd someday be, in top hat and overcoat and monocle. The Swan Gondola, its long neck broken, would sit shipwrecked at the bottom of the dry lagoon, the fossils of leaves speckling the winged hull. The fairgrounds deserved to become a sad, battered monument to every lost thing of beauty. Sentimentally yours, I was never sentimental before you happened to me, Ferret. And then the next section is labeled October through November, 1898. And it's not a letter, it's narrative. Emmeline and Hester, known in the county as the Old Sisters Egan, took their coffee cowboy style, the grounds fried up in a pan to a bitter sludge, then stirred into china teacups of hot water. They had their afternoon shot, as they called it, at the kitchen table, sharing a slice of a wet and heavy rum cake that gave them each a dizzy spell. The day had been as peaceful as any they'd ever known, so peaceful they'd only just commented on it. "So very, very quiet," had said Emmeline in her delicate, dreamy voice, drawing the words out, strumming her fingers through the air back and forth like across the strings of a harp. "Learn to love it," said Hester, "because it's the racket of your grave." At the uttering of the word grave, the house fell dark. The sunlight at the window seemed blown out with a sudden breath, but with a rumble and a roar and a shatter of glass, the house creaked and shivered, its joints an orchestra of great strain. Emmeline's set of china, long since excavated from her abandoned bridal trousseau, dropped from its tall cabinet, plate by plate by plate, smashing in an even rhythm, chipping at Emmeline's heart with each staccato burst. For nearly 2 decades now, the old sisters Egan had struggled to keep the outdoors out and the indoors in. To preserve a city elegance in order in their drafty country home, they always removed their muddy boots before stepping inside. On their floors, wood planks carved from old hemlock trees, they kept Persian rugs. Their living room, every evening, glowed a shade of jaundice from the oil lamps, and they strained their eyes to read in the dim light. Their walls were lined with books bound in leather. Emmeline read Russian novels in the original Russian, having retained the mother tongue, while Hester read volumes on medicine and remedies. Some books tumbled from their shelves. Balls of yarn fell from a basket to roll and unravel. A shadow box containing the wreath of a braid of a dead niece, gone too soon, fell from its nail in the wall, the domed glass of the frame shattering. The caged birds that sang through every minute of sunlight fell silent. The old sisters Egan looked at each other to share in their shock, a drama toward which Emmeline had always been inclined, but never, ever had Hester, and they took each other's hands, gripping tight. "I'm unafraid," Emmeline thought, pleased that she had at least this last sublime split second of Hester seeking ease. Despite all this wreckage and some chimney bricks that dropped into the hearth and choked the parlor with smoke and soot, the old sisters Egan realized the house wasn't being lifted from its moorings by an unlikely late autumn tornado. Something had fallen upon them. Hester opened the front door and took a slow step back, confused, worried that the drapery before her that cloaked the outdoors was a plot, the entire house shrouded in an act of theft or invasion. She lifted the rifle from the umbrella stand and cradled it, softly scratching her cheek with the end of the barrel. Emmeline recognized the pale yellow-gray fabric that hung before them. "Oh," she said, "Hester, it's silk." She reached out the door and stroked the silk with the backs of her fingers. They put on the new coats they'd bought for travel to the fair last month, the black sleeves and shoulders fashionably overpuffed. The coats had felt so conspicuous they'd ended up not wearing them to the fair after all and had never once worn them even off the farm. They stepped into the silk, lifting it, swimming out, hunkering down, nearly crawling to the other side. With the barrel of her rifle, Hester pushed the drape of the silk from her path. Once they had stepped away from the house, they looked up. They might have begun to worry over the damage that had been done had they not been so overwhelmed by the sight of this deflated balloon concealing their farmhouse. They walked arm in arm backward to take it all in, leaning in toward each other, their heads lifted to the roof, to the sky. They witnessed so much during their lives on the farm. One summer, they'd murdered a herd of cattle, shooting them to spare them death from a painful disease. They'd lost crops to plagues of weevils and worms. They'd built raging fires in fruitless efforts to ward off a freeze. They'd come to Nebraska together, lured by a promise of plenitude, but there'd been no mercy. The farm had given them little and had taken much of what they'd brought with them. But this fallen, ruined balloon, it seemed a generosity of spirit dropped down upon them from heaven, finally, at least, a worthless, senseless bit of wonder. Emmeline and Hester listened to the gentle rippling of the silk, sounding like wind on wheat fields. Escape the circus, Hester wondered. When Hester squinted, she could nearly imagine the grayish silk as the skin of a runaway elephant popped with a pin. At the end of the front lane was a stone bench no one ever sat upon, and they sat on it to watch the balloon do nothing. Surely, any minute now, they'd be overrun by people from town, the curiosity seekers who might have caught sight of the balloon falling. But so rarely did people look up at the sky. Their eyes were always cast down on that stubborn earth. Was the sky's endlessness too unsettling? Hester glanced across the horizon at a train on a distant track. Some days she could hear its clattering, the sound small, minuscule, almost unheard, like the tick and whir of a pocket watch. The old sisters Egan, in all the strangeness and clamor, didn't realize just then they'd seen this balloon before and that they knew well of its origins. It was a relic of the Civil War. At the Omaha World's Fair, war balloons had been tethered to the tops of a few buildings for display, balloons that had been used by both sides for spying and surveying, and this one, the Confederate one, had been sewn from silk that would otherwise have been used for dresses. When Hester had heard the guide speak of dress silk, she'd pictured all the pretty belles of the South carrying armloads of gowns to the war cause. She'd pictured the women looking as Emmeline had looked when she'd been young. She'd pictured rows of women with scissors picking at stitches, dismantling the dresses, then restitching the wrecked skirts and bodices, the monogrammed handkerchiefs and ruffled bloomers into a vast, delicate patchwork quilt. But before the illusion could linger long, the speaker in the hall corrected it. "Dress silk," he repeated, "not silk dresses." And as the crowd giggled, the image of ladies sacrificing faded away collectively. "The pilot," Emmeline said with a start. "Where?" Hester said. "Well, I don't know," she said, "but wouldn't there be one?" The women leapt from the bench and walked to where the balloon's ropes led them, to the other side of the house. Their brittle shards of dry grass crackled beneath their boots. They discovered the wicker basket upright on the ground. It tipped just slightly, empty but for a bottle of perfume that had somehow kept from falling out, extract of sweet pea, stoppered with a cork, its neck knotted round with a rose-colored ribbon. As the old sisters Egan scanned the landscape, seeking survivors or victims, Emmeline uncorked the bottle and dabbed fingertips of scent to the inside of her wrist. Emmeline and Hester walked in opposite directions, searching. Before catching sight of the pilot, Emmeline discovered a slightly cracked mask of papier-mâché in the dirt. Crouching, she picked up the mask by the chin with her finger and thumb. The face hadn't much character, a simple pink face with puckered red lips and wide, curious, childlike eyes of blue. She held it to her own face to see how things looked through the tiny pinholes, and she scanned the horizon. It was then she found the pilot. He was alive, flat on his back on the ground, not far off, his fists and his jaw clenched tight, his left leg in an awful bend. "Why wouldn't he just scream?" Emmeline wondered. "Why doesn't he beg us for help?" Maybe, she considered, he mistook the tall shoulders of their high-fashioned coats for the dark wings of death angels. Maybe he suspected them of scavenging for souls. Emmeline squatted next to the man as Hester pressed the point of her rifle to the man's left temple. Emmeline pushed the end of Hester's gun away, and she took the man's hand. She whispered a lie in his ear. "Your leg isn't broken," she said. "I can fix whatever's sick," the man said, appearing delirious, heady from pain. He snapped his fingers, and a card slipped out from up his sleeve. "B. Ferret Scarrett," the card read, "Omaha, Nebraska." And on the back, "This sleight of hand you just witnessed is only a hint of my wizardry." Emmeline removed her fancy coat and lay it on the ground. The old sisters Egan lifted the pilot, his body between them, and put him atop the coat. They then carried him in the sling of it, like on a stretcher, to the barn, where Hester kept an apothecary cabinet, veterinary implements, strips of muslin, tins of ether. And I'll stop there.